Good evening. My name is Andrew Freywald, and I'm the private client team leader at Islands. And joining me on the podcast this evening is Gareth Brown. Gareth is a jewellery valuation specialist based in the UK. Gareth is currently in Jersey for a few days just doing some valuations for a local jeweller. But we thought, whilst Gareth is in Jersey, we thought it would be a good opportunity to just have a catch-up and discuss some important topics that have kind of crossed over both of our industries over the last sort of few years. But before we kind of get into it, Gareth, I wondered if you could just introduce yourself, just let us know a little bit about your role and your business.
So yeah, good evening. As I say, my name's Gareth Brown. I'm the director of Clarity Valuations, a UK-based watch and jewellery valuation company. I'm a fellow of the Jewellery Valuers Association, along with a member of the Institute of Registered Valuers. So my whole purpose is just valuing watches and jewellery for predominantly insurance, but sometimes division of assets and probate purposes.
Cool. Thank you for that. I just thought it would be a good place to start. Obviously, we've gone back and forward about this quite a bit, but the secondary watch market,
yes,
I think, is an interesting topic to discuss. From my understanding of it, sort of 2019 to 20, that's kind of when it started to change a little bit.
Very much so, very much so. So the pre-owned watch market has been steadily increasing over a couple of years, but with sort of the pandemic and the lockdown and the lack of people being able to sort of spend money, they suddenly came out of lockdown with, you know, a bank account full of money or, you know, and funds and think, well, what do I want to spend it on? And that's driven a real sort of increase in purchasing of luxury watch brands such as Rolex and Patek Philippe and Audemars Piguet, amongst other brands. What that has done, along with the fact that the watch brands haven't been manufacturing for a couple of years, has meant that demand has just outstripped supply. So you've now got a situation where it's incredibly difficult to buy a watch from an authorised stockist, such as, say, Hettich in here in Jersey, who I'm doing work for. Very difficult to buy them from them, but what people are doing is then buying those watches, and they're ending up on the secondary market at significant premiums.
Indeed. I mean, I've done a little bit of research myself, and I can see, is it starting to calm down a little bit now?
It's certainly starting to cool down a little bit. Rolex is, I mean, not all watch brands have seen sharp increases like Rolex over the last few years. A lot of brands, you know, still trade at a reduced amount for the second-hand market, whereas Rolex, you know, the increases over the last sort of 12 to 18 months have been just phenomenal. You know, I think we were discussing this just the other week, a stainless steel Daytona this time last year. I mean, watch had a UK retail price of just over 10,000. September last year, it was 30,000 on the pre-owned market.
Yeah.
Then sort of earlier this year, about February, it went to 40,000. And then sort of March, it went to 50,000. And now we're back down to about 30,000-35,000 again. So, you know, certain models have been going up and down like a cardiograph.
Yeah. What do you think, the reasoning behind the madness, basically? Was it Brexit? You know, COVID-19 maybe affected that a little bit, do you think?
There's a multitude of things that have really influenced how the value has gone up. Rolex has always been an aspirational brand, more so than just about any other. But the price point has always been that it's been a difficult purchase for a lot of people when they have, you know, other sort of requirements for the funds throughout the year. But with COVID-19, no one going on holiday, you know, you don't go away on holiday, you don't go out and do things, you know, for a year, and all of a sudden you have, you know, enough funds to buy Rolex. So a lot of people are like, right, I'll go and buy myself one. And that's, you know, part and parcel, well, part of the reason why sort of the values have gone up. Historically low interest rates have weirdly sort of influenced that, because if you've got, say, £7,000-£8,000 sat in a bank, you're not making any money on it.
Indeed.
So as people saw the demand going up, you know, if you've got the money, you go and buy one, and then, you know, it's not a big jump to see a watch that's, say, £7,000 at retail, trading at £11,000-£12,000 on the pre-owned market. People thinking, well, I'll buy that for seven, I'll go and sell it for nine. You know, I've made £2,000 overnight.
Yeah. It's a no-brainer, isn't it?
It is a no-brainer.
Yeah. So, obviously, you mentioned it calming down a little bit now. What's the reason for the kind of easing out slightly?
Part of the reason is part of the reason is probably due to the fact that a lot of people went out and bought them, and all of a sudden you know, with the cost of living crisis, they're now looking at these watches thinking, well, that was a bit of a luxury. I don't really need it. I can't really justify having it now, you know, with a watch that I say spent, say, 4,800 on, and it's now worth 8,000, 9,000, 10,000. It's just like, do you know what? I can spend that. And that's us financially secure for the next 12 months. And like anything where, you know, demand and price are sort of factored in, the moment the market starts seeing, you know, people selling, prices start coming down. Because, you know, if you're trying to sell something and you're £1,000, £2,000 more than everybody else, you know, it's never going to go anywhere. So it's like any sort of word escapes me. It's like any sort of asset. You know, if you've got money tied up in it, and it all depends on how long you want to hold on to it for. Some people are like, I'm in it for the long game. Doesn't matter. It can sit in the drawer for 20 years. I don't care. Other people will look at it and think, I need that money, and I need that money now. Mm. You know, so they'll be forced to sell it at a much lower price than they would say normally. But if they've purchased it at retail, they're still making, you know, a substantial amount of money. And it's buying from authorized stockists now is difficult because they themselves are trying their best to try and screen the potential clients to ensure that the watches they're selling are going to people who actually aspire to own them and not to somebody who's just like, right, I'm going to buy this day, and it'll end up on any number of watch trading sites within 24 hours.
Is that a relatively new thing, you know, the obviously buying just to sell it on and Rolex kind of tracking that? Has that always been the case, or is it because they're in such short supply?
It's because they're in such short supply. It's, you know, 10, 15 years ago, there was no sort of pre-owned watch market, nowhere near like this. But I'll say historically low interest rates over the last sort of 10 years. You know, your sort of mid to high net worth clients who have liquidity, there's money in the bank, and it's just, what do I do with it? If I leave it in the bank, I'm not making anything. If I go and buy this watch, I can stick it in a drawer for 2-3 years.
Yeah.
You know, and when you're looking at sort of like an investment portfolio, if you've got, I don't know, £50,000, you know, you look at what you can buy with £50,000, you know, there's a lot of things that are factored out. Even if you had £100,000, £150,000, there's a lot of things that you could purchase, but they are inherently expensive in terms of legal fees, costs, taxes that go with it. You know, if you have £150,000 and you want to buy a property with it, it's a big purchase. You know, there's stamp duty to pay, there's legal fees, there's all additional costs. Mm. And when you come to sell it, you know, there's also additional costs. With watches, you could spend £150,000, buy pretty much a whole collection of watches. You know, £150,000 would get you most of the Rolex professional range and have change. And if you're looking at a watch that has a retail price of £7,000, and at, you know, one point earlier this year, it may have been £23,000, £24,000.
Yeah.
You know, it's a no-brainer. You can just, they're much easier to store, they're much easier to purchase, to hold, and they're very easy to move.
Mm. So if you just bought one just for investment sake, it's just a case of just storing it. Would you need to do anything with the watch? Would you, obviously you can get the automatic the winders. Would you is it just a case of leaving it?
It very much depends on, I mean, what you intend to do with the watch. Mm. You know, if you have any number of watches and you're going to be wearing them on a regular basis, no, you can just leave them in the individual box. Although I never recommend that. I always say you should keep the box and the paperwork separate from the watch. Maybe you can buy, you know, specialist little storage boxes to keep them in. Some have automatic winders. But I always say to people, like, however you store it, make sure it's in line with your insurance.
Indeed.
You know, the amount of people that will leave their £30,000-£40,000 watch on the bedside table. Mm. And you think to yourself, you might want to check the wording on your policy for that one. That one might have to be in the safe.
Indeed. And that's a good segue into the next question. You know, in terms of our industries crossing, you know, everything that you've just said highlights the importance of actually obtaining a valuation, you know, the changes in the secondary market. I'm interested to kind of know more about the valuation process. I know you're gonna show us later, but, you know, what are the logistics behind doing an actual valuation itself?
Excuse me. So the first logistics is actually getting hands-on with the watch. You know, from an independent valuation perspective, you want to ensure that what you're valuing is what it's purported to be. The amount of watches that have crossed my desk, which have been sort of, well, half fake, you know, fake bracelets, aftermarket dials. You know, so you want to get hands-on with the watch. You want to make sure that everything is as it should be. You know, and that's especially important with vintage pieces, where things such as the dial type, the text on the dial, the type of luminosity that's on the dial will make a difference to the overall replacement value. So it's getting hands-on, making sure that it works as it should work. You know, the amount of day-date Rolexes that I've seen, so that's the watch that will show you a date and the day, that are sort of Frankenstein sort of composites of other watches. So the amount of times I've taken a day-date, gone to change the date, it works fine, goes to change the day, doesn't work at all. So that's an indication that there's an issue with the watch, or as for one client, it was a aftermarket Chinese movement and someone had super glued the day wheel on.
Yeah. You've had to let a few clients down in terms of fakes, haven't you?
Very much so. My wife jokes that I upset at least one person a week. But unfortunately, lately, over the last sort of 8 to 12 months, I'd say it's probably averaging about two. There's a lot of people out there that, you know, they see the price increase on Rolex. And it's like anything, you know, if the deal seems too good to be true, it is. But some people don't take that into account, and they see a watch, you know, that's got a secondary market price of say 25,000-30,000, and someone's going to sell it to them for 14. You know, you've got to have your wits about you these days, but no more than you ever had to. Yeah. So yeah, it's all about getting hands on with the watch, making sure that the functions work fine, that it is as it should be, that, you know, it's the right bracelet, it's the right clasp. There's condition wise, you know, depending on the type of watch, condition is really, really important. But if you're dealing with vintage watches, originality trumps condition. You know, you could have a 1950s watch and it could be utterly battered and well loved. But if it's all original, it will still be worth more to the right collectors than one that has copious amounts of service replacement parts.
Yeah. You know, we touched on the secondary market, and, you know, from an insurance perspective, you know, it was previously, you know, you insure it for what you kind of pay for it.
Absolutely, yeah.
But nowadays, with this change, and I know you do it with your valuations, but you can add a secondary market value onto the valuation.
Yes. So, I mean, you know, say 10, 15 years ago, you know, it was new front, and it was really, really straightforward. It's just like, if you have a particular watch, whatever the list price is, that's replacement value, job done. You know, it was really straightforward. Now, you know, it's absolute chaos. And I say to people, you know, there is no shortage of Rolex, there's no shortage of Patek, there's no shortage of any brand. The only shortage is being able to buy them at the list price. If you were looking for like a modern Rolex GMT, for example, you go into any number of Rolex stockists, got no chance of finding one. Go and look at just one, you know, international trading platform, there's about 175 to choose from. Yeah. But what you'll find on that platform is the price ranges from maybe, say, 15,000 25,000, you know, and there's having a £10,000 swing on a replacement value is quite significant, because, you know, the client will probably expect theirs to be 25. The insurance company will look at it and say, well, yours is definitely going to be 15. It's like, where does that pendulum swing? And that's my job, you know. So I will look at the watch, I'll look at all the supporting documentation, condition, all the weird little nuances that impact the value, and then filter down all of the available sort of comparables to arrive at a selection which best represents that particular watch. Because ultimately, as you well know, the whole point of the insurance is to return you to a stage before the event as if it had never happened.
Indeed. Yeah. No, it's interesting to know. And obviously we've touched on the valuation side of things, but in terms of general maintenance of a luxury watch, what sort of advice would you give on that?
I would say, you know, it's no more complex than just about anything else. You know, if you're wearing it, obviously enjoy it. If you're out and about, obviously be mindful of your surroundings. There's a lot in the press, or has been recently, about watch thefts. You know, so be mindful of where you're going. Be mindful of who you're showing the watch to. You know, don't sit in a pub and say to your friend, oh, have you seen my new Rolex? Take it off and then hand it over. You know, be mindful of people that are asking you to check the time. You know, it's no more complex and dangerous than it used to be. You know, when I started in the trade in the mid-90s, there was a flurry of watch thefts, and the watch in question may have been, say, you know, like a 30, 40, 50,000 pound watch. It would have been all gold, set with diamonds, rubies, whatever. And the picture the papers would show would be of like an entry level Air King, which was like about £1,400. So everyone would see like a stainless steel watch and think, oh my God, I'm going to get my hand chopped off.
Yeah.
You know, it's not quite like that. But yeah, you know, like anything, especially with watches, you know, make sure that, you know, you look after it. If it's a waterproof watch, make sure the crown is screwed in. The amount of watches I've seen that fill up with water that someone has, especially at this time of year when they've changed the dates and changed the time, they haven't screwed the crown back down. They've then gone in the shower or they've gone washing, and all of a sudden there's water sloshing around the inside of their watch.
Not ideal.
No.
I saw something on LinkedIn that you posted, I think a couple of months ago. regarding watch boxes. You did it, was it a convention or a conference on boxes?
Yeah, Jewelry Valuers Association sort of yearly conference. I did a workshop on being able to spot fake watch boxes and fake documentation because it's become incredibly prevalent over the last couple of years. Solely because it used to be, if you go back sort of 10, 15, 20, 25 years, that a watch that came with the original box and papers would always trade for more money because it's closer to the day it left the shop as it'll ever get. So people always, you know, pay a little bit more for them. With the demand in the pre-owned market over the last couple of years, dealers have started thinking, well, do you know what, I can ask for more money if I've got a box for this watch. So what would happen is, and things, very rarely do people ever keep boxes and papers. Mm. You know, they're always, you know, they're either thrown out or they're put somewhere safe and then lost to the sands of time. So what some dealers and sellers, whether they were private as well, were doing were going on the internet, buying a box, and then, well, you know, and then putting it with the watch. And sometimes, you know, 5 years ago, I'd see, say, a 1995 Datejust with sort of 2008 box, and it being sold as having box and papers. Not really true. And as the years have gone on, it's less about genuine boxes with the wrong era watch. Now, you know, there's a whole market of Chinese fakes coming over where, name any brand, there's a fake box that goes with it. Mm-hmm. You know, and some boxes are really easy to spot. Some are really, really difficult. And again, it's not so much that it affects the value like it used to. It's more about being able to ascertain that everything as it should be. You know, so from sort of an insurance perspective, you know, or if, say from a loss adjuster's perspective, you know, if you're trying to like ascertain the validity of a claim, if you have a fake box that turns up on your desk as part of the validation process, that may not automatically indicate that the watch was fake, but it will raise questions, you know, and then you can start sort of probing that particular claim a little bit more. And obviously, if a watch has crossed my desk and it's got fake box and papers, it does affect the value, but it's marginally. It's nowhere near as significant as it used to be.
Hmm. What are you looking out for a fake box? Are there any sort of telltale?
There can be. 9 times out of 10, it's sort of the finish. Fakes are designed to look as close to the original as possible for the least amount of money spent. So typically there's always some telltale signs in terms of the condition, the materials and the finish. Sometimes it will be really obvious. It will be spelling. It will be sort of text, because obviously English is not the Chinese first language. So you'll be surprised how many things are misspelt. And it could be something, you know, a lot of the machines are interchangeable. A lot of the boxes are interchangeable what I would say is a sort of aftermarket sort of manufacturing process. So you'll see, I've seen Rolex boxes with Tudor written on them. So sometimes it can be really, really obvious. Sometimes it can be really difficult. Sometimes you'll be looking at it and you think something's not right. And it will be that the text is ever so slightly misaligned.
Right.
So some would say some are very good,
yeah,
but some are quite bad.
Interesting to know. Just to kind of switch it up a little bit, you know, if you there's an individual, you know, brand new to kind of the watch collection process, you know, what sort of advice would you give them? Any hints, tips to kind of look out for?
Yeah, I'd say absolutely buy something that you like. You know, don't be swayed by the sort of perceived notion of you have to have this particular brand or you have to buy this particular watch or you have to spend that sort of money. But the one piece of advice I'd give to absolutely anybody, without hesitation, is never, ever, under any circumstances, buy aftermarket customized watches. You know, it may seem like that. So that's a sort of watch that is been aftermarket set with diamonds, or they've changed the dial color, or, you know, they put, you know, their own little logo on the bracelet or something like that. It looks lovely at the time of purchase, and, you know, you might pay a premium for it. But in terms of ownership, further down the road, that's going to cause you nothing but trouble. Because, so for example, if you had a Rolex which has aftermarket diamond set case or aftermarket diamond set bezel or bracelet, anything like that, if it goes back to Rolex, and Rolex are quite accommodating like this, you know, if you send it back to them for a service because it stopped working, they'll be like, yeah, we can service that for you, it's not a problem, but we want to return it to factory standard at your expense. So we, you know, if you've got aftermarket set case, it's like, well, we'll take that case off, you have to have a whole new case. Cost for that. So you've got aftermarket set bracelet, no, that goes as well. And they will service it, but they will return it straight to factory at your expense. So if you've paid a premium of, say, I don't know what the premium is, but let's just say you spent £10,000 on an aftermarket set bracelet, and has to go back to Rolex for service. Rolex are like, it'll cost you £5,000 to return it to factory. Otherwise, they won't do it. Mm. Then you'll have brands like Patek who will smile, thank you for sending the watch in and send it back. That doesn't matter who you are, they won't touch it.
Right.
So you're kind of stuck because pretty much all the watch brands are closed houses, they're closed shops. You know, they will only give replacement parts to their own workshops or their accredited outsourced workshops. So there'll be jewelers who have accounts and qualified technicians who have attended their courses and they're accredited, and they'll supply them with parts. And most of the parts now are done on an exchange basis. So if you have, say, a Rolex and it needed a new mainspring, for example, you'd have, you know, you took it into, say, Hettich. Hettich would have to send the old mainspring back before Rolex would send them a new one. That is designed to really sort of filter out the grey market sort of repairs to make it considerably harder for people to be able to get their watches serviced outside an accredited setting. So if you have an aftermarket set watch, you have, you know, you, there's only a few options you can do to get them repaired. You either send them back to the authorised stockist, who most of them won't touch it, so you're then stuck with a watch that you, you know, you spent significant money on a watch that you can't do anything with, or you can go to the grey market, so non-accredited, but where are they getting their parts? They'll either be cannibalising them from old watches, so they will be used parts, you know, won't have the longevity to maintain the watch that a new part would, guarantee is going to be minimal, or they're going to be aftermarket replacement parts that are generic that come from China. And then you end up with that sort of, you end up with that tipping point of, it's like the ship of Theseus. At what point do you replace so many parts in the watch that it stops being a Rolex or a Patek or an Omega or a Breitling? You know, so aftermarkets are set, you know, advertised as being wonderful, luxury, sort of, you know, customised, but they are nothing but a bag full of rusty nails.
Interesting. Solid solid advice. And sticking on the sort of same theme, I know you've probably been asked this question many times, but are there any watches out there that you kind of, that stick out as a one to watch? Pardon the pun.
One to watch. Honestly, if, and I said this to you when we met up for the last time, I said, if I honestly knew that, I'd be living on a tropical island like a Bond villain. But I don't. But I would say any sort of watch that hasn't been changed for a while, especially with Rolex. So Rolex have, for one, one would describe them as one of the most sedate design teams in the world. You know, they are glacial in their ability to change anything. And when they do tweak it, it will be something silly, like we've made the case 1 millimeter bigger, or we've made the case 3 millimeters smaller, and that will be it. So any sort of Rolex, that, you know, especially Rolex, that hasn't changed for a while. The one I would say at the moment is probably the Milgauss, because they haven't tweaked it or changed it. Or the Air King hasn't really been changed significantly for some time. And typically what happens is, as soon as the watch has been discontinued, that's when demand picks up and everybody wants one. But, you know, Rolex are... Rolex, Patek, Audemars, brands like that are, they're just weird little enigmas. You know, the desirability for that particular piece really drives the value. You know, no disrespect to like a brand like Breitling, but, you know, Breitling have wonderful watches. You know, their Navitimer range has been around for many years, and they're incredibly well-made watches. But when they discontinue a model, the price just goes. It doesn't. Mm. It doesn't increase. It's peculiar. But going back to sort of the previous question is, you know, if you're looking to buy something, don't buy if you're looking to try and find the next best thing or the next big thing. You buy something that you're going to enjoy watching, enjoy wearing, and buy something that, you know, is within budget. There's any number of brands out there that, you know, you can get really, really nice watches that are interesting, they're well made, you know, and they're just good all-around watches. Mm.
And dealing with as many watches as you do,
yes.
Have you got a favourite?
Brand or watch?
Both.
Well, that's like saying, what's your favourite drink? You know, it very much depends on the mood. You noticed, so when I walked in, you were surprised that I wasn't wearing a Rolex today.
He was.
Yeah, he was. But that's because I'm wearing a Bremont. So Bremont is it's a really interesting brand. It's an all-British brand. Everything's made in the UK. And I like them because it's an aviation sort of themed watch. It's got a nice, it's got a very sort of IWC sort of feel to it. But what I like about them is they're producing really small numbers. Mm. You know, so as you're right, I do see a lot of watches. And when I'm out and about, it's a side effect of the job that I'm always looking at people's watches. And I want something that was a little bit different that I don't see a lot of. And Bremont was the ones I don't see many of. And strangely, it's one of the ones that gets the most interest. You know, wear one of my Rolexes many times, no one ever notices. As soon as I wear the Breitling, sorry, the Bremont, people are like, "That's interesting. What's that?" But you know, it's just the watch of the day.
Well, we've covered some good sort of discussion points there from an insurance side of things. Is there anything that you kind of are curious about
in regards to sort of like policy? So obviously, you know, I've done a valuation, and the valuation sort of comes over to yourself. The one thing I speak to when I speak to clients is, especially with watch, modern watches, where there is a significant premium over the replacement value. So obviously, you know, if you've got a Rolex now, you know, typically my valuation will have two values on it. It'll have the retail price and a statement that is a current piece, but availability is limited, as so, you know, replacement would be difficult, and obviously has a premium price. You know, that confuses a lot of clients, because they're just like, "Well, I thought my policy's new for old." You know, can you give me, what would you say, what sort of advice could you give me to say to them, and say when they come to you, what they need to ask if they're unsure about how best to insure it?
Yeah, so it all depends on the value, and it all depends on the type of policy.
Yeah.
So if someone has a home contents policy already, they may all, you know, already have some coverage there. But like I say, it all depends on the value, because certain policies that we deal with do have a single article limit on the policy, meaning that if you've bought a watch that's say under 10,000, you'd have some, you know, that would be covered automatically under your personal belongings section. However, if it's over say 10,000, which is a common single article limit under a policy, if your Rolex is over 10,000, then you need to advise your insurers. You would insure that as a specified item under that policy, potentially at a small additional cost, but then that'll be listed under your policy. And in terms of, you know, conditions that might come along with that, a common condition that you might have on a policy is, for example, and like I say, it all depends on the value, and it all depends on the insurer, but if it's say over 15,000, the insurer might request that that watch is inspected every say 36 months, just to ensure that it's in working order. You know, it's a settings and fastenings condition.
Yes.
So just making sure that, you know, everything's in working order, and if it's not, any sort of defects are remedied.
And for example, you know, they say £10,000 is a healthy single article limit. Obviously, if a claim was made, the claimer would still have to prove where from £1 to £9,999 it would. What sort of advice would you give, or would you suggest people do to try and be able to narrow down that sort of position of where that piece is going to go? You know, because I always say to clients, you know, if it's over your single article limit, it has to be. You know, if you want it insured, you know, you don't have to have it insured, but you know, if you're not going to insure it, tell your insurance company. But I always say to people, you know, if it's under, it's really up to them whether they get it done. So obviously, I understand it's tricky, because there's, you know, a lot of nuances based on the type of policy, the insurer. But I mean, what sort of conditions would you expect to see on like a policy that, you know, for say a high end or in demand sort of watch?
Yeah, so just touching on the settings and fastening condition again, but also I think it used to be that the client would buy a watch and, you know, insure it for the list price. But because of the changes in the secondary market now, it just highlights the importance of getting a valuation. And obviously, we touched on it before, that you can add the secondary market value on the valuation. So it's a different decision for the client, because, you know, they can add it onto their policy for list price, what they've paid for it. But if they do have a claim, you know, what's the waiting list going to be like at that time? So you might have a client that would prefer to insure it for the secondary market value, and then at least if they're, you know, if they've got a keen eye for watches, they've done some research, then, you know, they can maybe source one on the secondary market. So obviously, if you did insure it for secondary market value, obviously it's going to be higher, so you'd be paying more for it, of course. But at least the indemnity that you get back on that would be enough to kind of go out to the secondary market to do that. So that's kind of what we've been suggesting to our clients. It's quite new, so it's you know, we do have clients at the moment that, you know, might not be aware of the changes in the market, and that's something that, you know, if we are seeing a client has got X amount of Rolexes on their policy, then we'd always recommend doing that because of the changes. Some clients are, yep, I know that, I'm aware of that, whereas others, they, I don't think they've realised the severity of what kind of has gone on.
Yeah, no, I mean, Rolex have had two price increases this year. So, you know, if you had bought, I don't know, let's just say you were very lucky and you had waited a good year and you picked up a GMT in sort of December of 2021, you know, it's gone up twice this year. And if you've only insured it for what you paid, obviously, you know, you're underinsured. One would argue, would that then sort of creep into the realm of being knowingly underinsured? You know, and it's a, if your payout is for the list price minus two replacement values or price increases, you know, you can't expect your insurance company to suddenly stump up the extra cash to cover the difference.
I think that could be a good place to kind of call it. I think we've covered a lot of great topics tonight, Gareth, and we really appreciate you coming in and spending some time. I found it really interesting, very enjoyable. And yeah, on behalf of myself and Islands, thanks a lot. Safe journey home, and next time you're over, we'll have a get together and a chat. And yeah, appreciate your time. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. We'll be right back.